Welcome to the Pre-K Teach and Play podcast, where solutionaries are reclaiming children's right to learn through play, reimagining inclusive classrooms, and revolutionizing early care and education. Here's your host, Dr. Christy Preti-Fronczak.
Hey everyone, this is Dr. Christy Preti-Fronczak, and this is episode number 40 of the Pre-K Teach and Play podcast. Today I have, wow, the most amazing guests. I know I say that every time, but seriously, these three women, these three amazing scholars and thinkers and teachers have been on my podcast before, and the universe just allowed everything to align that I had them all in one place, all at one time. Today we have the most amazing Dr. Shauna Tominey, Alyssa Blass Campbell, and Laura Fish. And the reason I brought them all together was to talk about three big topics. We try to do it justice. I know we won't go deeply enough for some of you, but I hope that you will find that their wisdom around the topics of when and when not to praise, the use of rewards, and this little thing called punishment. Those are three humongous issues that we grapple with. And so I couldn't think of a better way to take it on than to have Shauna and Alyssa and Laura all talk about what those words mean to them and how they teach and help support parents and teachers and others who are building children's brains think about and work through the nuances of this idea of praise, rewards, and punishment. Quick backstory, Alyssa had done a podcast episode with Alfie Cohen. The link to it will be in the show notes, and I highly recommend that you listen to it, not because it's an easy listen to, but because it will definitely get you thinking about your own thoughts around the use of praise, rewards, and punishment. And so Alyssa did this amazing thing where she went back after her conversation with Alfie and did another layer of introspection, reflection, and teaching to help us think through the difficulties. And that got me to thinking like, wow, we really haven't spent enough time even talking about what do we mean about the word praise? What are synonyms with the word? What does it mean and look like in group care? What does it look like from the intersect of race and ability and gender and class and language and spirituality and religion and all of these things? So I sat them down and we tried really hard to go in a really structured way so that each of these amazing scholars, thinkers, writers, bloggers, podcasters, speakers could talk about what they meant by the word and then where their teachings overlapped and built upon one another. And then we took practical scenarios from the real world, from where you all live and work every day. And we tried to say, but what do we do in that moment? Where can we find a different path forward? What can we let go of because it's no longer serving us? What can we do because, well, we're really rocking it. We should just keep doing it. And then where do we really inspire to do differently? So I hope that you find that by the time we close this episode and we talk a little bit about our hope. Shauna unfortunately had to get off a little bit early because we just kept talking, but you'll hear the hope that Alyssa and Laura have for our work with building young children's brain. And I hope that you were able to take tons of practical things and put them into your work every day so that you can help all children thrive, not only in school, but in life. Let's have a listen.
And so the lightning rounds will cover three big terms. The first will be praise, the second will be rewards, and the third will be punishment. And we're going to just go around and have each of my amazing guests in just a few minutes, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes each, say what they think of, how they define or conceptualize the word, and even just their work around it, how they teach others about it, how they move through this world around it. So Laura, we're going to start with you. The floor is yours to talk about what does the word praise mean to you and in your work?
Well, praise for me, I've had a relationship with praise for quite a while. And we're going to be looking at praise, rewards, and punishment. And all three of them for me have something in common. They're, for me, they're attempts to teach children to either repeat the good behavior or stop the bad behavior, to put it in just concrete terms. But each one comes with certain side effects, in my opinion. So praise can lead to dependency on these external reinforcers, and praise has been shown to be ineffective in the long term. So I'm really trying in my work to help people update their software, is what I call it, meaning their perspective, their beliefs, so they can shift from these more traditional strategies, such as praise, that have been shown to have their limitations, toward what I call 21st century thinking and teaching. So this teaching with the brain and mind is all about cultivating awareness. So how can I, instead of using something like praise as a motivator, how can I shift my perspective to, I'm trying to cultivate both my awareness as the adult and the child, casting the spotlight of attention onto what is, either what went well in the case of praise or what didn't go so well. So fine-tuning our awareness skills so we can look intrapersonally inside and interpersonally. So to that end, I use the strategy called positive descriptive acknowledgement, or PDA. That comes from the work that I did with the teaching pyramid with WestEd, PDA and PDA Plus. And what that is simply describing children's positive actions aloud, just like capturing it like a camera, without the value judgments or labels that are inherent to praise. And it also includes taking away the I notice, I see. Because the risk with that, the possibility with that, is that the child's awareness or attention becomes focused on you, the adult, and not him or herself. So PDA can sound like you're sharing the toys, or you're taking turns, or it looks like you're using your walking feet. And then PDA Plus is three categories. The one is you add on a character trait. You're using your walking feet, you're being safe. Or you add on an emotion, a potential emotion. So you're sharing the toys. Looks like you're excited to share. And the third is encouraging children to cast a spotlight of their attention onto the impact of their behavior. So it's that shared gaze of, I'm sharing, looks like you're sharing the toys. Now Alyssa can color too. So that's what I've been shifting away from praise towards positive descriptive acknowledgement, because it aligns more readily with my value of cultivating awareness in children.
Very, very helpful. Okay. And I think what we'll do is, after we go this round, I'm just thinking that we'll do a couple of scenarios. Those were really helpful exemplars. And so after all three of you have talked a little bit, we can talk about some common scenarios. I even was using ones that I found myself saying when I was in the classroom last week that just came out. And so then what do I do? So, yeah. All right. So Alyssa, let's hear your thoughts about this word called praise.
I think that it's a loaded one. I also agree. So in creating the SEP method, collaborative emotion processing method, the basis of all of it for us is mindfulness is at the center. And then we have five components that stem from that. But it's really building mindfulness of our biases, mindfulness of our own regulation. Mindfulness for me is always at the core of everything, just building, which for me is synonymous really with what you were saying there, Laura, of awareness. And just building this awareness and becoming mindful of, like, first, like, as the adult, what's my goal here in using whatever words I'm going to use? What am I trying to achieve in doing this? And when I'm working with teachers, like, that's really been my foundation for whether we're talking about, yeah, praise, rewards, punishment. First, I want you to identify, before we go into what the practices are, like, what's your goal? Are you trying to get them to leave this classroom and go to the playground? Like, what's your goal here? Like, an obedient child that's going to walk in line? And it's okay to say yes to that. Like, maybe sometimes you're like, yeah, that is my goal today. Like, I'm in survival mode, right? Like, that's okay too. But first we have to identify, like, what is the goal that you're getting at here? Because then we can, I think, work backwards from that and say, all right, then what are you using to get to that goal? I think for a lot of us, that praise has become something that is driving us to, like, that end goal, whether it's, oh, did you notice me? And it is really a cornerstone in our system a lot of the times. I was working in a child care center doing consulting recently, and you walked by, there was this bulletin board of all the teachers, and it was like highlighting kind things that they had each done with their, like, faces attached to it and whatever. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Like, it was in my mind praise for these kind things that they'd done. And at what point does it become like acknowledgement of versus praise because we want more of those kind things? I think for me, it can be murky. In my interview with Elfie Cohn that we talked about, when he kept doing this voice that made my skin crawl, but he would say like, good job. And I'm like, ooh, that does make my skin crawl. Cause again, like, what's your goal here? What does good job accomplish? But wow, that was so thoughtful of you to hold that door when she was walking in behind you. For me, also could be praise or could fall under that umbrella of praise, mm-hmm. but has a different end result. Mm-hmm. So I'm working at a goal and then coming back from that. And I think also we touched for a second on cultural differences mm-hmm. and norms. And I think that this is one thing to consider is like when we're looking culturally as a whole, like maybe your end goal here is an obedient child. And maybe we'll talk more about that. But if what I really want to know is what's your end goal? And in some cultures, that's going to vary.
Alyssa, would you say like goal and intention
are not interchangeable for
okay,
me?
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
No, I think our end goal is like what we're trying to achieve, right? Like when I just gave a workshop to parents and was like, when you think of like your child as an adult, what does that look like for you?
Okay.
What is your dream here? And they're like, I want happy kids is usually what I hear. Then we get to dive into that, which is a whole other can of worms. But the intention might not be to have an obedient child, right? The intention might be to work collaboratively with this kid and find common ground to get out the door. Or it might be that we're working towards this goal of an obedient child.
All right. So Shauna, your thoughts and your teachings around praise.
Sure. Thank you so much. And I loved hearing both what Laura had to share as well as Alyssa. It really helped me think about what to share in this moment as well. And it made me think back to just how much I value that we're each taking time to think about what does praise mean? How are we coming at this in terms of the way we're defining this? Because so often from that educator and parenting perspective as well, when folks hear the word praise or see a headline about to praise or not to praise, what they're thinking about or putting praise into is more this general idea of just positive or kind words with our children or the children in our lives. And that's not always how, when we come at it from an educator's perspective or a researcher perspective, that's not always the way that it's being defined. And so I love that, you know, Laura, you stepped back and thought about this in terms of positive descriptive acknowledgement. And that links so closely in my mind to what Alyssa said around mindfulness. Now, what is it that we're noticing with those kind words? So treating our children, the children in our lives, from a kind and positive perspective, what is it that we're noticing? What is it we're giving attention to? Those are the kinds of things that I think about when I think about this idea of praise versus encouragement versus mindfulness and thinking about, really, it does come down to that end goal. What do we want to give attention to? Is it, there's been a lot of debate about praise versus encouragement. Are we praising the child themselves? You're so smart. You're so great. You're such an artist. You're such an athlete. Versus that idea of a growth mindset of really encouraging the effort. You spent a lot of time on that. You worked very hard on that. I saw you spend half an hour working on this so carefully and making changes along the way. Wow, that took a lot of patience. So when I think about praise or where we might want to head as a field around praise, encouragement, mindfulness, I love that we're going more in that direction of not saying, well, we either use positive and kind words and that's praise or it's not, versus this idea of there are a lot of different ways we can use kind words to talk with children to help them and to help us reach those goals.
Yeah, so we'll call this a rebuttal phase. I don't know. I'm making this up. But now, because, you know, Shauna does, she was smart going third because she could sort of connect dots. So Laura or Alyssa, what dots did that make for you all?
When I was listening to it, the first thing that like popped into my head when you were talking was this idea of like self-love. And I haven't yet made the connection as to that full thing. But I was like, oh man, like how do we foster this self-love and figuring out like, what does bring me joy? What do I personally feel proud of? Like, regardless of what somebody else might be proud of for me or in me or about me, and really how to foster that as we're breaking down these terms.
Well, and that brings it back too, to what Laura was saying about not making it so much about the adult. So how do we use our words in kind and positive ways to help children identify what it is they feel proud of? Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah, you got it. And that's what I love about the PDA and the PDA Plus. It's been really challenging working with it because it's very natural for us to say, I saw you were, or I noticed you were. And I'm not saying that's bad, but I'm saying it's kind of superfluous. It's kind of extra because of course you noticed it or you saw it because you're saying it. And the risk with that is it becomes about us. The child who is wired to tune in to their adults is like, oh, what is my adult saying versus me just coming in and saying, looks like you or Jacob, you or Liam, you, and really just pretending to be a camera. And so again, when we talk about cross-culturally, we want children to have their interior landscape mirrored back to them. So we want, instead of saying I and me and from my perspective as a white female saying what I see and I notice, I'm just going to simply give to the child a mirror and look at yourself. Look at yourself. We talk about mirrors and windows for children. Do I see my world, my experience mirrored back to me, or am I always seeing a window through which I have to look through? So that's tied to issues of race and ethnicity and bias and things. So that's what I love about this too, is taking away and just simply say the my perspective and simply saying to the child, this is what's happening. This is the camera. And then sometimes if you say to a child, you took turns on the bike, you look really proud. They'll say, I'm not proud. I'm happy. Oh, you're happy. That looks like you're happy. You shared the bike. You took turns on the bike. So in terms of what we're talking about, what Alyssa said with the self-love, absolutely. And the broader category is insight. Awareness and insight. So we're really focused a lot of times on teaching children empathy. That's a great thing. But as Dan Siegel talks about, it's insight and empathy creates mindsight. And that's part of the mindfulness practices and this awareness that I'm talking about.
I don't know that we can ever fully pull ourselves out of like what we notice, because I think all of us, what we notice in a situation or what might stand out to us, even if we are like sportscasting, like saying what we see without the words I notice. I think for us as the adult in the situation, like building mindfulness of our own biases is going to be huge in being able to even identify different things. Like maybe we noticed the sharing part, and so that we talk about the bike sharing, but perhaps someone was feeling nervous about somebody taking that bike from them, so they just gave it up, right? Like I think our lens in which we end up sports casting is always going to have a bias. You know what I mean? Like I think for me, like that's one thing that is sticking with me as we're talking about like not using the words I noticed or that's what I saw, yet takes us out of it. And also I think it's important for us to be mindful as we move forward that we're always noticing things from our bias.
Absolutely. And that's what I meant by you can take out I notice because it's clear you're noticing.
Yeah.
The fact that you're using words to convey packets of energy and information means you noticed. And I'm not against noticing. I want teachers to notice. So this awareness is also for the parents or the caregivers. It's also awareness, your own as the adult. But it's taking out that explicitness that it came from you and put the focus more on the child. Because you're right. I want people to notice, and I want them to cultivate a relationship with noticing. It's just skipping over that part where it's the I notice, I see, I like how you, I am proud of you. Not that you can never say I'm proud of you, but there's a saying I like to say that praise is like sugar and PDA is like vegetables. So praise feels good and we all like it and just like sugar, but there's really not that much nutritive value in it. Whereas PDA is more of a vegetable quality that it's not, might not be so exciting up front, but over time it can help grow and cultivate the mind and the brain in the context of relationships.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think it gives rise then to those questions too, that you were drawing all of that toward Alyssa around, are we doing this in an equitable way for all of the children in our care? Who are we noticing? Mm-hmm. When? In what way? And are we doing that in the same way for children, regardless of their gender or their race or other implicit biases that we may not be aware of in ourselves? How does that shape who we're paying attention to in what contexts and when?
This is one of those points where my growth is going to show as being novice, but I was reading a post this morning about how the emphasis in whiteness on individuals is part of the white dominant context. You see me trying to get the right words here. And so I'm setting that up to bring a little bit of closure to what y'all were alluding to in terms of what we do notice in individual children, but also this notion of singling out or individualizing. Could that have a negative side? But then my real question is, where do you all stand with broad comments about the group? So giving praise or kind words, but you use your own definitions to explain. But when you hear people say, I see everyone's cleaning up, or everyone looks ready to learn, or maybe worse yet, I see Laura's ready to learn as a goal to get Alyssa and Shauna to buck up and pay attention. So there's kind of three questions at least in there. But what about when I say things that are just sort of to everyone or anyone who might be listening, / when I call out an individual child as a model? Pros, cons, do's and don'ts. Who wants to go first?
Oh, I got like a fire inside me.
All right, go. Like, what's up?
With the last one, where like, oh, I'm a human and my whole life, this is who I am. If you were to be like, oh, Laura's ready to learn, I would do absolutely everything in my power to not do what Laura's doing. If your end goal is to get me to just do what she's doing, I'd rather you said like, oh, hey, is there something that you need to calm your body to come over to circle? I see that you're still moving a lot. Looks like you're not ready to come sit. Is there something that you need? Would much rather be asked than be like trying tricked into something still as an adult human. When you said it, I was like, whoosh, cortisol. What, yikes. So I have obviously strong feelings about that. I think like I don't see the benefit of identifying what is happening with somebody else's body in an effort to get another child to mirror that. It's really hard for me to make sense of. Instead, I want to turn to the child who isn't really ready and figure out what's going on. Hey, bud, looks like you're having a hard time coming over. Is something going on? I want to check in. How are you feeling? What's going on? Maybe they need to move their body in some capacity. Maybe something happened while they were playing that they're carrying with them and they're not ready to go over here. So I want to check in for sure. And in terms of the blanket statement, honestly, like, I feel like we live in a world where these are going to happen all of the time or a lot of the time. I feel like in general, even just like in common workspaces as adults, there's a lot of praise that happens across the board. I think societally we live in very much a punishment reward system in a lot of ways, and praise is a part of it. I don't think it's something that's going to totally go away. I don't think it causes irreparable damage. I just don't think it's super effective. That makes sense?
Yes. Perfectly helpful. Right. Who else is ready? If people could see this, they would see y'all like ready just to go. Like, is it my turn? Because I got to tell you something.
To your point as well, Alyssa, I think you gave such a great example of yourself in pointing at how individual children respond differently. And for some children, hearing words that point something out about who they are or what they did, that is a moment where they stand up taller and straighter, and someone else next to them looks at them and says, I want to do that too. And that gets them to jump up in line. But for others, it's not. And for still others, they may be growing up in homes or cultures where being prideful is a shameful thing to be or goes against their family culture. And so looking at these blanket statements or one size fits all statements put some children in a position where they feel like, oh, great, I'm doing really well today, versus others where I don't belong, or I'm not being seen, or she's saying this, but I don't feel like it's me.
Laura, you wanna?
Oh, yes. I got so into it, I forgot I was part of the podcast. Oh, this podcast is good. I'm enjoying it.
If we find you over in your sauna, we know we're in trouble.
I'm in the sauna. The thing for me, I love everything everybody is saying. And then what kept going through my mind was the quote, comparison is the thief of happiness. And I think in my work with adults as a therapist, I'm really working with that a lot. And so comparison makes my skin crawl too. Like, I like how Laura's sitting to try to get Alyssa or Shauna to do it. I don't like that. I don't teach praise. So what I do want to promote is interconnectedness. And it's a sense of interconnection, right? So how can we do that in ways that feel appropriate? And again, with all of this, with the PDA Plus, with encouragement affirmation, of course, we're going to look how we do it. It changes depending on who we're with, just as Shauna was mentioning. It's not a blanket fits all, but looking for a way to promote that interdependency. So that's the only time I could see trying to do kind of the group thing, but not in a way to manipulate them to get them to do something. More in a, wow, looks like you guys are all working really hard to put away your toys. We've got super teamwork going on here, right? Or just something about where it's that shared, again, the shared gaze of looking around going, oh, I'm doing it, but so are you. We're all doing it, or we're not, you know, we're all working together. So again, being careful, being cautious with that, because some children too don't want to be, they're more of that, you know, introvert temperament, might not like that type of group stuff. So again, we have these tools and we have to use them mindfully. But I like the idea of diminishing comparison and promoting the interconnectedness, mm-hmm. which takes a lot of skill.
A lot of skill. Yeah. So, okay. Because there are three topics, I'm going to go to the second one. But if we have time, we'll come back to more about praise, okay? Yeah. But we're going to do another lightning round. And if you guys are okay with the same order, or you want to change? Same?
Sure.
All right. So what we'll do now is we're going to move to this word rewards, knowing that each time there may be something that you carry over from the first one because there's some relationship, as you started us off, Laura, in your comments. But let's talk again, couple, 2-3 minutes. What do you classify as rewards? What synonyms do you use? And what in your teachings do you have to say about the use of rewards?
For me, I really pull in this thread of awareness. So sitting with adults, parents, caregivers, teachers, and really talking about, like Alyssa said, with the goal, what's your goal when you're rewarding, and thinking about what we're trying to activate. A lot of times people are trying to activate is just the ability for children to notice, reflect, and repeat whatever that was that they thought deserved a reward. So if we could take out that extrinsic reward, like, you know, food or a sticker or whatever the extrinsic reward is, and instead teach the internal process, what would that be like? I know we live in a world with extrinsic rewards. I go to my job and I get a paycheck. So it's not saying that it's all bad, but what we're really going after is really sculpting the neuronal processes that promote the ability to take in the good. So Rick Hansen talks about we have Velcro for the bad and Teflon for the good. And the way to counter that is to try to create the positive neuroplasticity. And that comes from literally practicing taking in the good. And again, one of the greatest labs I have for how to work with children is working with the adults that I do in my private practice and watching how I have to really start at basics of getting them to take in the good. Mm-hmm. So as Rick Hansen says, we waste good moments. We rush past the good and focus on the bad. So I want them to really stop and pause and what he calls heal, have, enrich, absorb, and linger in the positive. So we can move from a state to a trait. That's learning. So the reward is often so ephemeral and so it's often so not really linked mm-hmm. that it doesn't have its effect. So my nephew got this little bracelet the other day while he was at camp. And when he came home, he said, I got this bracelet. And I said, what's it for? And he said, for being respectful. I said, what did you do? And he said, I have no idea. So instead of in those moments taking in whatever capacity, and I have ideas, but we're just talking generally now, in whatever capacity to take in the good, to have it, enrich it, work with it, keep it in your mind's eye for long enough for it to be installed as an experience that has lasting impact. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm interested in.
Laura, I'm here for all of that. I do struggle a little bit with the idea of punishment reward because we live in the system. And so like, I do have this battle and like internally where I'm like, ooh, if I was in sales and I like worked really hard and got these sales and then I got this commission bonus, like that is how that's structured and I'm working for that and I'm excited when I get that. What it comes back to for me is making sure the reward whenever they exist is not necessarily the end goal, but as a part of the process. So I think of like, I was thinking of like coaches of mine. I grew up as an athlete and I never went into a basketball season saying like, great, we're going to win every game or I'm going to have the highest number of points I can't shoot to save my life. But for me, it was like, ooh, what am I going to be working on in this? And like the reward for me was when I could get that drill down really well or build that new skill along the way. It wasn't necessarily winning the game or having the most points. It was about that process of like skill building. When I think of like the best coaches for me, which I found more of like positive rewards in my life in coaching than in it from teachers, to be honest. And in this, like someone stuck out to me where he was right there with like rewards along the way for the process. And I just remember like wrapping up this one practice and I was bummed about a mistake I just kept making. And he was like, all right, let's look at the system then. Like what can we tweak here? And he just turned and he was like, I'm not disappointed in you. And I was like, well, I don't get to, there were like special things you could do if you did certain like parts of the drill. And I was like, well, I don't get to do this. He was like, no, you didn't reach that, but you can work on doing that tomorrow. Like, let's look at the system as a whole. He wasn't focused on the end reward. He wanted me to like fine tune the process. Mm-hmm. And actually just last week in therapy, I said to my therapist, like, I just never want to make the same mistake twice. I don't mind making mistakes throughout my life. Mm-hmm. I don't want to repeat the same mistakes over and over. And I think it has come from this place of like process for me that I want to be able to like fine tune things. And rewards have been a part of that for me, but it's not always the end goal. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm going to come back to something on that. But I'm going to let Shauna go and then we're going to come back to that, Alyssa. Shauna, so do you have synonyms for this? Do you have examples of what are reward? I can't get my grammar right, but you go.
Okay. So rather than bringing in synonyms around rewards, I think I'd like to link back around that idea of process.
Okay.
And also both from what Alyssa was saying, but also from what Laura was saying about keeping the positive in your mind's eye. And how do we think about not just the extrinsic rewards? Because so often when we think of a reward, we're thinking about money, stickers, food, you know, physical, tangible things, rather than thinking about what are those intrinsic rewards we get from that process along the way. And as you were pointing out, Laura, from Rick Hansen's work, so often we don't focus on the positive. The positive things, they're not putting us in danger. They're not the things that our brain needs to hold on to save us when that situation comes up again, for us to be in heightened awareness of. They're the kinds of things that, well, all's going well. So it just, like Teflon, it's there. We don't need to hold on to it, to be thinking about it, to be watching for it to happen again. But how do we use that knowledge of, if we linger on those positive things, if we really think about the process and celebrate the process along the way, can that be the reward? Can we shift what the reward is for our children and for ourselves in terms of, it's not the extrinsic, what we're adding from the outside that sometimes has nothing to do with the process. You know, having a piece of candy or a sticker may have nothing to do with sticking with that task, sticking. I see the pun there with the sticker, unintentional, but it might not have something to do with that actual task that we did or something we accomplished or something we worked so hard on. And if instead we sit with that and talk about what that felt like and what that feels like now and how we might use that again, can that be the reward that we're teaching our children and ourselves? So that was something that I often think about in terms of, how do we shift what we think of as a reward? And then going back to a word that you used earlier, Laura, interconnectedness, having those pleasant or positive experiences together where we feel connected, we feel like we're able to share, we feel like we're able to be with someone in a way that makes us feel good. Is that a reward in itself too?
I'm going to play devil's advocate, or at least present a real life challenge for this, kind of piggybacking on to and expanding what you guys just heard each other say. And I know we have a lot of listeners who are trained in behavioral learning practices, myself included. We have many people who have spent a lifetime achieving to get a BCBA even, or other rewards having expertise in around behavioral learning principles. So let's take a common scenario. And I also want to overlay this with not all children, as we know, are easy to connect with. Not all children right. are verbal, have the cognitive capacity to make the connection between cause and effect, on and on. So let's take that kind of reality that so many of our revolutionary members are in. And you have a little child who needs to transition from preschool classroom to the bus. This is high stakes because the bus has to leave and there's no other way to get the child home other than the bus. So I just want to make it really specific scenario. This is a little child who has trouble on all levels with sensory. So knowing where they're going is a problem. Knowing what they've just been doing for the last 2.5 hours is trouble. We got a pot that's ready to boil. And so a teacher says to her behavioral team, I'm really struggling getting this kid in his gear and to the bus all the way from the classroom through the hallway to the bus with our gear. That's the scenario. And so somebody on the team or the district said, here's a strategy, teacher. I want you to take and break up some crackers or have some mini M&Ms or have something small. And each time they are making the repeated progress towards the bus, I want you to reinforce it with a morsel. I know it's a big question, but that immediately of a next step, what could we do?
What's the goal? Is the goal to have a kid okay. who needs this to get from point A to point B in the long term? At what point is this something that we would say, like, it's no longer age appropriate? I'll often hear when I'm working in elementary, and that, like, they've aged out of this practice. So what plan in place would we have then if at some point this kid's not going to be offered this? Mm. As a way to move from point A to point B. This is me starting at the goal. So if our goal is like, no, he knows how to independently put on his stuff and get to the bus, then my next steps are going to be different. Does that make sense? Mm. So that's my first question, is like, what's the end goal here? Not just the immediate, yeah, we need this kid on the bus today. Okay. What's the end goal here? And from a sensory perspective, my work is heavily rooted in mm-hmm. sensory systems. We cannot talk about emotional development without sensory systems. And so I would want to look at, like, what supports do we have throughout the day to help him maintain regulation? So we're not trying mm-hmm. to backtrack at the end of the day with a dysregulated child. How are we maintaining regulation throughout the day? And then what visual aid supports can we implement that can help get him through the steps he needs to get through at the end of the day? It's a lot of transitions for a kiddo at the end of the day. What visual aid supports, or even buddy system. I had a 3-year-old who really struggled with organizational skills. You see sensory regulation, and his, like, best gal pal in the classroom was amazing. And she would come, she would get herself ready, and then she would come, like, kind of like play this game back and forth that they really started to implement together. And then we were just like, yeah, go for it. And she would help him, like, get his stuff together at the end of the day. And so, like, is there some sort of like internal buddy system that could be supportive? Really, I'd be focusing on sensory regulation, and visual okay. aids would be my go-to.
Okay.
Okay, I'll jump in. So I agree. I love that. The sensory is really important. And I was thinking, as you were saying it too, Christy, I've had this exact scenario so many times, actually. Being in this field for so long has really brought is this additional understanding of the brain. And I'm thinking, we know that the brain scans for signs of welcome and signs of warning. All brains, all ages, right out of even in utero, it's believed. So scanning for signs of welcome and signs of warning. So I would sit down with the adults and really think about what could be welcoming about this process. What could we think of? And of course, it doesn't start with when it's time to get on the bus. Just as Alyssa said, it's throughout the entire day, including all the sensory stuff. So what is going to signify to this child? This is a welcome transition. And so trying to see it from his or her perspective. And I think that's what the intention is with the M&Ms or the gummies or the crackers. The child is soothed by food. And so that can move them along through that transition. I would like to get away from that. I have strong feelings about our relationship with food and our relationship with food as a motivator. And it can definitely be problematic. So I really want to be careful with that and look for something else that might be a motivator. But just the main goal is to keep that child feeling seen, soothed, safe, and secure as they're making that transition. So I do not have a strategy because I don't know what child you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So it has to be individualized for that child. But what are the signs of welcome that could ease that child's transition? And also for the adult to keep them feeling seen, soothed, safe, and satisfied too, and secure, because it's scary for the adult and there's that time crunch and all the pressures on the adults. I have so much compassion for. So everybody coming at it from that time, so like what can create that emotional and physical safety in that moment for them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's so important in terms of thinking about the adult as well, because jumping to that reward or jumping to a punishment is sometimes the strategy or the process that's going to have the quickest result in the moment. And that's why when we're exhausted, when we don't know what else to do, pulling out those M&Ms to just get through this moment feels like it's going to be okay. And when we think about the difference, as you said, Alyssa, with goals, is it the immediate goal or are we in danger right now? Are we in a situation where we absolutely need to move a child from point A to point B and there is nothing... That has to be our goal. There is a time component. There is potentially even a danger component. This has to happen right now. When we're in more of a crisis mode or more of a, we just have to get through this moment, sometimes we might make a choice that we have to make rather than the one that's really thinking about the long-term goal of, okay, what does this child need in terms of support? Where is their potential for growth and learning? And then stepping back and saying, even if I can't put that into this moment right now, how do I move outside of this emotionally charged moment or this crisis moment or this time crunch moment where I can't think anything except just get from here to there, to how do we build these moments of growth and learning and support outside of those moments so that we can then bring it back into this moment?
Shauna's going to have to jump off and I know I need not keep you guys. So I'm going to quickly get her to define punishment and then Shauna, you'll step out as you need to and then we'll get some closure to the whole thing. Our third word is this word called punishment. And this time we're going to start with you, Shauna, and you can tell us what you think about that word, how you teach about that word, what comes up for you. And then we'll go to Alyssa and then to Laura, and then we'll talk about a scenario. So punishment.
Sure. So with punishments, there are a couple of different definitions with punishments. There's sort of the more traditional psychological side of punishment that actually has to do with adding something negative to a child's environment, like a spanking. But oftentimes we think about punishment now as taking things away from children as well, even though that can also be called negative reinforcement or have other terms. And punishment has been linked so often to shame, to this feeling that we're potentially instilling in children around there's something wrong with you, rather than there's an area for you to grow or learn or be supported. If we're looking more at a mindfulness approach to talking about a child's behavior or their emotions, or a growth mindset approach to that. Moving more to the punishment side, something we see is taking children out of learning opportunities, or pulling them away from a group, or not letting them go out to recess, when we know that sometimes those children who maybe are struggling or learning about how to use their bodies in a really effective way, how to be a learner, how to be a good friend, might need that just as much or even more than other children who are around them. One of the things that I struggle with as I think about punishment and how we respond to children sometimes in those challenging moments is so often when a child is struggling, let's say with self-regulation, with emotion regulation, with not being able to manage their bodies, their feelings, their voices. So often what we do is we resort to isolating them, pulling them out of a group, telling other children to stay away from them or don't be around them when they're like that, don't talk to them when they're like that, rather than saying, this is one of our classmates or this is one of our friends and he or she or they are struggling or they're learning and we can move toward them rather than away from them to help them in those situations. So I really struggle with seeing punishment being used as a way of removing children from situations that are ultimately helping them practice the skills that they need.
Mm-hmm. Alyssa?
I think punishment is often about control and like asserting our dominance in a situation. Or if we feel a loss of control and as the adult are trying to regain it, maybe if somebody is hurting somebody else's body and we want, like I think there can be an assertion coming from a place of fear. What I often see confused here is like boundary setting and holding and punishment. And especially in my work with parents, we're like, well, I don't want to have to like do this. Like, I don't want to have to put them in the car seat and buckle them. Like, yeah, nobody wants to do that. And it's your job to keep them safe. And if you give them an option of you can climb into your car seat or I can put you into your car seat, and they know the time limit in which they have to make that decision and all that, they have all the information and they choose not to do it, then you're enforcing that boundary. I think is different in the same way that, like, if I choose to speed, there's a chance I could get a ticket. I could choose not to speed and maybe not get a ticket, especially as a white female. That's where I want to be mindful as we talk about punishments. And what I often see is this confusion between like setting and holding a boundary where everyone has all the information here versus like a punishment for someone that for me is often from a place of fear and control. And yeah, I like that you pointed out shame, I think plays a huge role in punishment. I think the shame part is linked to this like assertion for control. Like, if you are feeling shame, then I might feel dominant in my position.
Laura?
I totally agree. It goes back to the signs of our nervous system scanning for signs of welcome and warning. And adults feel when there's challenging behavior, their warning bells go off. And so no shame or blame on the adult either. It's no wonder. No wonder our nervous systems are on overload. And so traditionally what we do, all we know is punishment. And so the great thing about 21st century teaching is we know much more about the brain and mind in the context of relationships, and we don't have to just punish. We have options. It's just bringing these options to adults and helping them update their software. So instead of punishing, we teach. When things go wrong, we want them to strengthen the awareness again of what happens. So they may engage in reflection with adults and possibly repair if needed. But if we punish, we risk activating that downstairs brain, or what Rick Hansen refers to as the red and the blue zones, where learning and awareness are shut down. So if we focus on creating awareness, we use approaches such as, I don't know, the steps to problem solving or conflict resolution. We have a framework. Whoa, what happened? How do you feel? Yeah, oh yeah. What solutions can we try? So it doesn't go that fast, but those are some of the steps. Leaning in, attuning to the child in the moment to offer that co-regulation, that open, receptive place that we need to be in, which is hard, to say like, okay, what happened? How do you feel? And really leaning in to help cultivate their awareness. We create the shared gaze around the issue, and then we come up with a plan for how to teach them, for how they can grow. Mm-hmm. And that may include repair, not saying I'm sorry, but feeling compassion, feeling insight, feeling empathy for yourself too, not others. I work with a lot of children who do self-harming behaviors when they do something quote unquote bad. So I also want them to be able to make that repair with themselves and not have the internal narrative that I hear sometimes. I'm just a bad boy. I'm just stupid. Mm-hmm. We really want to keep our gaze on how can we step into a place where there's been challenging behavior and instead of punish, use it as a teachable opportunity. But teachable can also be loaded because people think, well, I'm teaching him, I'm putting him in timeout. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about teaching from a place of awareness, which is mindfulness. Awareness to me is paying attention to what is with openness and receptivity, which is the same definition I use for mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So it's this place of coming from the brain perspective of, we don't want to send more information into that child's brain that signals warning, 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 danger. So it starts with us getting into that balanced place and then promoting that in them through co-regulation, attuned interaction to try to teach rather than punish.
I love that so much. And I love that you brought up the co-regulation. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we underserve teachers. Lauren and I co-created the collaborative emotion processing method because we felt like this was what was lacking for us as teachers. It's five components, and one is adult-child interactions. The other four are about us. It's about our own biases, awareness, and regulation and self-care. And like, what do those four things look like in your everyday life so that you are able to bring awareness to what you're feeling, what you're bringing to the table, what your biases are in this situation and across the board, your ability to regulate, even just understanding our own sensory systems and like what helps me feel calm? I've asked so many adults and they don't know that answer. And so I think like we have, as you're saying, like 21st century teaching, we got to take a step back and look at like, what did we grow up with? What tools don't we have yet that we need support in building so we can co-regulate? How do we advocate for our own self-care as a teacher? What can that practice look like in reality? I think that those components have to come into this in order for us to be regulated humans in the classroom in order to co-regulate.
For sure. I mean, it is the parallel process. And I am really committed to that currently. When I'm asked to come and do some speaking engagements, I'm really trying to advocate for getting these skills for the teachers and really looking at, we're trying to ask them to teach emotional intelligence, and yet they've never had practice or opportunity in developing it for themselves. I cannot go and teach a physics class, girls, because there's no way. I never took physics. I don't know anything about physics. So now we're asking people to teach these things. It's like, well, it was never taught to us. We got by. We're okay. We developed coping mechanisms, not nearly coping strategies, Alyssa, right? So, but again, no shame and blame. And the shame thing, Brené Brown talks about, guilt is I did something bad. Shame is I am bad. Mm-hmm. And that is what drives me. I don't want anyone, adult, child, anywhere, feeling I am bad. It's just looking at, and not even the bad, I don't even use that. It's like, oof, what happened? How do I feel? So we don't even have to label it as bad or good. I'm not avoiding that. I'm not afraid of that, but I'm not anchored to that. And so my goal is to develop the child, not manage the classroom. Mm-hmm. And with the practices that we're all talking about, we're talking about child development, not classroom management. And the hidden secret in that is the spoiler alert is your classroom will be managed if you help develop the child. But it starts with us really engaging in ongoing self-understanding and self-development, self-growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's let Shauna get her like closing statement in, and then we'll go to the two of you.
So much of what you were sharing, I was like, oh, yes, yes, and yes, more of that. From both of you, one of the words that came out from both of you is co-regulation. And this applies so much to the child level as well as the adult level and the interaction in between. I think too often we have language that we use around self-regulation, but that's the goal. You need to learn how to self-regulate. That implies in itself, even with that language, that the end goal is for you to be on your own. Whereas shifting that language to the importance of co-regulation, we need to be able to manage ourselves in those moments, but we should always be relying on co-regulation with each other. That we always need other people to help us work through challenges or to grow, to learn, to problem solve, and applying that to children in classrooms, in the relationship with each other, in the relationships with the adults in their lives, and then flipping it back, Alyssa, something you said, Nate, and Laura, you as well, made me think about just that even for educators, feeling like you're in this on your own, you've got to figure this out for yourself so that you can teach it rather than follow a process and we're in it together. So that co-regulation word and that piece as being foundational to all of this.
And regulation tickles my fancy, but I think when we are saying just self-regulation, we're only talking about self-regulation, we're literally just ignoring the science of mirror neurons that you are going to co-regulate in some capacity. It might be that you're now spiking cortisol because they're spiking cortisol. Either way, you're going to fire off each other here. You're going to mirror each other. And this is where I think self-regulation is key. It's not the child's job to get calm for you. It's your job to get calm for them.
And if I could piggyback on that, it's the self-regulation to me, the first part of that word, self, engenders insight. So again, going back to the insight, how can I regulate if I don't have my internal landscape, if I don't have the mechanisms in my brain, the neural pathways to look inward and tune intrapersonally? So self-regulation includes co-regulation. So insight and empathy equals mindsight, equals your foundation for social emotional skills. It's not everything, but we've got to self-regulation includes the co-regulation, but it starts with we definitely want. It doesn't start with, because we are co-regulating ongoing, but we want to make sure we don't overdo, we overlook the self part. I hear it in classrooms all the time, you guys do too. Look how you made Shauna feel. Look how you made Alyssa feel. First of all, we don't make anyone feel anything. And then second of all, what about how I felt? So if I hit Shauna over the head to get the red truck, and all I want to focus on, all you tell me to focus on is how she feels, you've totally missed the teaching opportunity, not on purpose, no shame or blame, but you've missed the chance of like, hey, what happened for me in that moment? Oh, I know. I was frustrated because I couldn't get the red truck and she had it. Oh, so next time I'm frustrated, I can do this. And yes, Shauna also gets to weigh in and say, that really hurt me. I feel really frustrated. Now I'm scared of you. So it's both and it's insight and empathy.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to trusting kids and intention. Like, here's that word intention for me, but like trusting that their intention is good and that it isn't malicious. And so if somebody is hurting somebody else, like what's going on for you? When I'm going to triage that situation, I'm not always going to the child who got hit, right? Like the child who hit might need me more in that moment. And when we talk about self-reg for SEP, we say that you cannot have self-reg without self-awareness. That self-awareness comes first before all of it, before empathy, before social awareness. Self-awareness is the cornerstone of starting your emotional development journey.
What I'd like you to do is think about what is one thing you would wish for people, your dream for them, what you're hopeful about, what tip. It could just be super practical, like just try this, but just leave those who have joined us and are listening with one key takeaway, something that if you strip it all down, kind of like where you sort of started to lead us there, Alyssa, but without this, you can't have that.
This is actually like so fresh in my mind right now because we're creating this certification program for child care centers. So I'm doing all these trainings and it's all these video trainings, like guiding teachers through how do you do this work? And we just did the like outline for where do you start? So it's very fresh right here. We start with not doing anything different, just noticing. So paying attention to, like, we consider it part of reflective practice, but it can be during the day. We ask you to do it once a day at the end of your day, looking back at where we call the wheels came off the bus. Like, where did you feel dysregulated? Where did you feel like the classroom felt chaotic, or you didn't feel like you were working together with your co-teacher? Where did the wheels come off the bus with you today or for you today? And just starting to pay attention to those before we're doing anything, we've got to be aware, right? Like, this is, again, the awareness is key. So building awareness there, just paying attention to those things. And we have like a guide that walks you through like what really to pay attention to, including like then taking you into potential biases here of what social programming might exist for you within this. I have a training that's all about really diving into your childhood, your upbringing, your cultural norms, and just getting to know them. Because what is normal for us, what are our cultural norms, are things we often don't examine because they feel just normal to us. And so getting to know those a bit, especially in a classroom setting where you're going to have a bunch of kids who will have different levels of normal and you're all commingling, right? And so it can bring up a lot that is just automatic for you that you might not be aware of yet. So really just starting from this place of awareness where you're participating in reflective practice, not with the goal yet of changing anything, just getting to know yourself and your habits and your patterns so that you can look at this as a whole. And then you can really start to get insight into where can things be tweaked or what should I be mindful of when I'm going into X, Y, and Z situation? I give this example of, I'm a sexual assault survivor, and I started to notice in my toddler classroom that when there was a group of kiddos all like hanging out in like rough and tumble scenarios, if it was all girls, I was fine with it and I was relaxed. If there was a boy over there, I was on edge. And I had to start to notice this pattern myself so that I could learn to regulate it and be able to respond with intention, but I couldn't regulate it until I was aware of my pattern.
Very powerful. Okay. Laura?
Message of hope. I love that. Hope activates an open, receptive state of mind. So my succinct message of hope is, it's never too late. Mm-hmm. Never too late for the child. It's never too late for the adults. We know about neuroplasticity. We know behavior can change. I had two 80-year-olds in my office not too long ago, and the wife looked at the husband and said, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I said, you know what? In fact, you can. It is harder later. It's easier earlier, but it's never easy. It's a process, but the message is it's never too late. And this noticing that Alyssa's speaking of is that awareness piece is very complex. So self-reflection is really difficult because we're in our movie. It's hard to see our movie and we have our lenses and our biases. So what I find very important is giving teachers an opportunity to meet with an attuned other, a coach, a peer, even just themselves, and looking, especially using videotape to try to start to overcome some of that being in the movie. So I videotape teachers and I meet with the entire team and I pull them all out and we look at, as part of our reflective practice, we look at the movie and it's interesting, in a 1 minute clip, everybody sees something different. So that's where I get some of my evidence that self-reflection is very difficult because we're in the movie. But when you're sitting with attuned others that you trust, you can start to reflect upon some of what's there, what you missed, what you saw, what you might hope and intend for the future. And it's just an ongoing process. But the foundation of that is knowing that it's ongoing. We've never arrived. You never gain insight and you're done. It's an ongoing process. You never gain empathy and you're done. It's never done. You're just always working to cultivate that and grow that and just being okay with that, which is hard for so many people. So find who you can sit with and meet with to go through this process, and then how you can enter into it with a sense of like, this is ongoing and it's okay. That doesn't mean I'm falling behind. It means I'm on the journey.
Perfect. Beautiful. See, I say perfect, beautiful. And I'm like, dang, I just praised her. I don't know what to say.
Praise is like sugar. Praise is like sugar. It's okay. I do a little bit of sugar. Yeah, I'm going to go have some broccoli after this.
Okay.
Yeah.
A few quick things as we wrap up this episode. First, a note of gratitude to my guests for their wisdom, generosity, and willingness to support the early care and education revolution so deeply. Second, do you know about my ECE Solutionary Membership Program? It's a special membership library chock full of hundreds of searchable resources and tools that you can have in hand at the click of a button. Visit prekteachandplay.com/ECE-membership to learn more and become a member today. Lastly, if you were inspired by this episode, if something affirmed your beliefs, or perhaps you discovered a practical tool you can put into practice to help all children thrive in school and in life, then I invite you to share the episode on whatever app you're using. Share with someone you feel would benefit or someone who would be inspired by today's conversation. Someone who it will make a difference for. Then be sure to subscribe so you can stay connected. With so much gratitude for all that you do, fellow revolutionaries. Until next time.